This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Kremlin File. And today we have a very, very special guest. His name is David Cramer. And David was Foreign Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor in the George W. Bush administration. He was also former president of Freedom House, Director of European Eurasian Studies, Senior Fellow in the Vaclav Havel Program for Human Rights and Diplomacy. Also, member of the Task Force on U.S. Strategy for Support of Democracy and Counter-Authoritarianism. So this is absolutely incredible because he's had, a lifetime of defending, democracy. And this is what we actually need right now. Extremely
absolutely
important.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, he was also the senior director for human rights and human freedom in the McCain Institute. And, as we all know, McCain was a very big champion of human rights and democracies around the globe.
I was really struck by a lot of his work that he did at Freedom House, because I know that Freedom House, they surveil, they also do a lot of, they gather a lot of information on the state of democracy in the world, which is extremely important to see where there's a backsliding of democratic institutions and democratic norms. I think without any further ado, why don't we say hi to David and welcome him to Kremlin File.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's just jump in, into some questions that we would like a few years back, in your extensive experience as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, and you had responsibilities for Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Moldova. This is just to remind everyone, you were instrumental in the U.S. response to the Russian invasion into Georgia in 2008. What was your experience during that time? And how has it shaped your dealings with Russia since?
So I had joined the State Department in the Bush administration and was in several previous positions before I took on that position that you mentioned. And increasingly, I think, became aware of the growing challenge that we faced from the Putin regime. Early on in the Bush administration, as we all may recall, President Putin was one of the first leaders to call President Bush on 9/11. He and President Bush had a summit in Ljubljana in the summer of 2001 before 9/11. And that's when President Bush, of course, famously referred to looking into President Putin's eyes and getting a sense of his soul. But the relationship started to become strained throughout the 2000s. And by the time of Russia's invasion of Georgia, I actually had already moved on to a different position within the State Department.
Okay. Overseas, a fierce battle broke out today on the fringe of the former Soviet Union. Tonight, Secretary of State Rice is calling on Russia to end its assault on the Republic of Georgia, now a U.S. ally.
But based on my experience, I was not surprised. Though I think a lot of people were. I won't say that I had predicted it, but it indicated to me that Mr. Putin was prepared to undertake any measures necessary in order to deal with what he viewed as challenges along his border as well as within his borders.
Okay. Actually, at the time, Senator McCain, your former boss, famously said, "We are all Georgians." Okay, what do you think he meant by that? And has this actually held up over time?
I think it was a bit of a paraphrase of President Kennedy when he said, Ich bin ein Berliner, basically trying to say, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
It was a way for Senator McCain to say that we feel the pain of Georgians as they were facing assault from Russian tanks and planes and helicopters. And I think it was a way to indicate American support and solidarity for Georgia during this difficult time.
Right.
Remember that in August of 2008, this was just a few months before the U.S. presidential election. And I think Senator McCain, who was a candidate then against Senator Obama, was trying to strike a harder line toward dealing with Putin and the threat that he perceived. And it did become a bit of a competition between Senator McCain and Senator Obama on who could stake out a tougher line.
Well, I was interested in Senator Obama's reaction to the Russian aggression against Georgia. His first statement was, both sides ought to show restraint. Again, a little bit of naivete there. He doesn't understand that Russia committed serious aggression against Georgia.
No, actually, I think Senator McCain and I agree for the most part on these issues. Obviously, I disagree with this notion that somehow we did not forcefully object to Russians going into Georgia. I immediately said that this was illegal and objectionable.
That, of course, changed after the U.S. election when Senator Obama became President Obama and then followed through on his reset policy.
Okay. Actually, speaking a little more about Senator McCain, for those of us who monitor the threat that is posed by the Kremlin, his absence, I mean, we really miss, his absence is, we can feel it, every day.
Yeah.
Is there anyone in government that you see who we can look to fill the shoes of the senator, let's say, in this space?
It's a great question because I think we've seen an interesting dynamic over the past 4, 5, 6 years. Republicans tended to be more hawkish on foreign policy and toward Russia in particular, or toward the Putin regime in particular. I won't say Democrats were doves by comparison, but they did seem more open and prone toward extending a hand to Moscow to try to work with the Russian government. That kind of flipped during the Trump administration, where the more hawkish side became the Democrats. And the softer side became the Republicans. That said, I would say that there are members on both sides of the aisle who I think have had a healthy skepticism, if not a pretty negative view toward what Putin has been doing. That would include, I think, Senator Cardin, Ben Cardin from Maryland, who currently chairs the U.S. Helsinki Commission. And has been a strong leader and advocate on human rights. He and Senator McCain, in fact, played key roles in passage of the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law and Accountability Act in 2012.
Right. Yep.
Senator Shaheen, I think, has been very good on this. Senator Rubio has taken a tough line when it comes to Russia. But I'm not sure any of them is necessarily looking to follow the path of Senator McCain. He was a unique individual. On the House side, I will mention Congressman Kinzinger, I think has staked out a very clear position when it comes to dealing with the Putin regime. Congressman McGovern, who chairs the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission, has been terrific as well.
Great.
So there are a number of members, again, both sides of the political aisle, who I think do have a good understanding of the threat and challenge posed by Mr. Putin.
Yeah, both sides are needed in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I don't think, I don't think it's just one party or the other, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
David, so going back to Georgia, 2008, we watched Russia invade Georgia. Since then, we have seen Russia invade Ukraine. We have seen ongoing attacks in basically a full hybrid war launched against the U.S. We saw the atrocities that the Russians helped Assad commit in Syria. And I mean, their involvement in pretty much every single election in Europe. If Putin would have been stopped back then, do you think a lot of this could have been avoided?
I do wish that we had taken a harder line earlier. I would even go back, Olga, to the spring of 2007 when Russia launched a massive cyber attack against Estonia. That was the first real challenge to a NATO member state. Estonia became a member of NATO in 2004, and NATO was not prepared to respond to a cyber attack. Article 5, which comes with NATO membership, Article 5 in the NATO Charter, says an attack on one is considered an attack on all. If Estonia had said, we have just been attacked, I'm not sure what NATO would have done. Estonia didn't say that because I think they were worried that if they did issue that statement, that it would not be backed up by NATO allies. We didn't do much in response to that attack. There were no sanctions imposed. There was no real pushback. We did help Estonia beef up its cybersecurity, and Estonia is one of the leaders now when it comes to cyber issues. But you could even go back further to the murder of Anna Politkovskaya in October of 2006. I think not coincidentally on Putin's birthday. I think that was deliberate. And then followed soon after by the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko, who had been a KGB officer, but then sought asylum in the UK in London and was poisoned with polonium, a radioactive substance, in a London hotel and died a few weeks later, a terrible, painful death. We didn't do anything in response to that either. And so I think there is sadly a litany of cases one could cite where Putin really pushed the envelope and we didn't push back. And that emboldened him to think, OK, I got away with the poisoning of a former spy in London. Again, another member with a banned radioactive substance, and then Estonia, then Georgia. Then Ukraine. But in between Ukraine, I think it is important and worth pointing out when President Obama said he was drawing a red line on Syria if Assad was going to use chemical weapons and then didn't follow through on warning and threat. Putin again saw an opening for Ukraine in 2014. He moved. And then since then, of course, we've seen, as you said, the situation in Syria, interference in our elections, cyber and ransomware attacks. The list goes on and on. And it seems to me we're not doing enough to push back.
The scale of human rights crimes that, was committed by that regime, I mean, it's unspeakable, you know, and I definitely should be factored into the foreign policy by Western, leaders.
Yeah, which they don't do, which is not there, right? Human rights is not factored in at all.
It's not unique to Russia in our U.S. foreign policy. There tend to be, at a risk of oversimplifying, three basket of issues and interests that the United States has. Security, economic and energy interests, but then the normative side, the democracy and human rights basket. And sadly, I know this from my own experience in state, even with President Bush emphasizing the freedom agenda, the democracy human rights basket often gets shortchanged throughout the years, not just in one administration. And that, I think, has been true in the case of dealing with Russia. The reset policy, in my view, did put not completely to the side, but did minimize democracy and human rights concerns at a time when the situation was getting worse inside Russia. And there was emphasis on the New START Treaty, which got signed. There was emphasis on getting Russia into the WTO, cooperation on Afghanistan, and of course, dealing with the Iranian nuclear threat. And those are important issues. But just to pick up on your point, it also seems to me no less important are democracy and human rights concerns, our values, our universal values, not just our values, universal values.
Absolutely.
And they get shortchanged.
Yeah, we're with you on this one, 100%.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's not the U.S. either. In the EU, we have the same situation going on.
100%, so, you know, right.
This is why, right, when we talk about these things, Olga and I actually say the West, because this is what is happening.
And with Putin pushing, you know, the line, like David said, using new chemical weapons on foreign soil. I mean, you know, we saw it with Litvinenko. We saw it with Skripal. I mean, we saw the Czech bombings where you had two Czech citizens die during the Skripal poisoning using Novichok. You know, a British citizen died.
By the same guys who likely were involved in the Novichok poisoning of Skripal.
Exactly.
And Catalonia.
And Catalonia. Sometimes they use the old-fashioned way of guns, just shooting people down in the middle of Berlin or in Vienna. So it isn't just with banned substances. But they do it, though, in part because they think they can get away with it.
And they do.
I mean, Dmitry Lugovoy, remember, was promoted into the Russian parliament.
Yeah, yes,
exactly.
So
he got an award when he got home.
Exactly.
You know, he was honored. He was honored in Parliament.
Exactly.
Right. Actually, I have a... go ahead, Olga. Go ahead, love.
Go ahead.
No, I have... Since we're talking about, you know, people who have risked their lives and everything, David, when you were president of Freedom House, you were put on Putin's enemy list, along with Bill Browder. Okay, why were you put on that list?
Well, it may have actually come more formally later when President Trump met with President Putin in Helsinki. I have not been back to Moscow since 2009 and have not had a desire to go back, even though I have a number of Russian friends there.
Yeah.
And I did help Bill Browder, who runs something called Hermitage Capital. Used to be one of the, if not the biggest portfolio investor in Russia until Bill ran into some problems and the Russians revoked his visa, kicked him out, and then arrested his accountant lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, who then was killed in prison. And Bill was behind a cause to pass legislation in memory of Magnitsky. To try to hold Russian officials accountable for gross human rights abuses. And that seemed to me to be a worthy, laudable cause, which I then decided to support from my position at Freedom House and helped to try to persuade members of Congress that this was the right thing to do. I mentioned Senator Cardin before. Senator McCain played a key role in this.
Yes.
Congressman McGovern and former Congresswoman Ileana Ross-Layton and also played a very important role in passage of this legislation that passed by huge bipartisan majorities, 92 to 4 in the Senate, for example.
Wow.
So I've been outspoken in my criticism of the Putin regime. I have I supported that passage of that legislation. And then when it came to the Helsinki summit, remember, this was in the middle of the Mueller investigation. The Mueller investigation was looking at the possibility of criminality between Russians and people in the Trump campaign. President Putin said he would agree to allow Russians whom Mueller was interested in talking to be interrogated if President Trump agreed to allow, I think it was a list of 12 of us, to be interrogated by Russian inspectors.
Okay.
And I was on that list. Mike McFaul was on that list. And a number of other people were too. And so I assume it was because of my association with the Magnitsky legislation.
Incredible.
Touching on Helsinki, because I have a question about that. I remember, I mean, I followed this very closely, you know, from the beginning, from when Trump decided to run. And at Helsinki, I mean, my blood was boiling. I can't even tell you the anger I felt. I probably the first time I even cursed on Twitter. Trump stood with Putin on the world stage and took the side of Russian intelligence thugs. over American intelligence and their attack. And they were still attacking America. I mean, the attack by no means is over. It's been happening. And he took Putin's side and Russian intelligence.
People came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be. I have great confidence in my intelligence people, but I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer.
What were you thinking about that? Like, what was going through your head seeing an American president standing and taking the side of our adversaries' intelligence services?
Did that make you explode, David? What happened to you?
Well, you know, it wasn't our proudest moment, to put it mildly. Fiona Hill and I were, she was a year behind me in graduate school, and we've known each other for many years. And I think she has famously said she thought of feigning illness, passing out, or going up and pulling a fire alarm or something. It was not a good day, to say the least. And that particular moment it was a pretty bad time, I have to say. That was not a great performance for President Trump. I think it did renew the concerns about his attitude toward Mr. Putin and what he had in mind with Russia. To me, President Trump repeatedly asked the wrong question, and it was more of a rhetorical question on his part, but he kept saying, wouldn't it be great if we and Russia got along? And the answer to that in an ideal world is yes, of course it would be great. But it's the wrong question to ask. The better question President Trump should have asked would have been, wouldn't it be great if we and Russia got along without having the U.S. sacrifice other countries in the region, our interests, and our values? And the answer to that question is, it's not going to happen. That's the only way we and the Putin regime could get along. And so I do think that he had a fundamental misunderstanding of the threat posed by Putin. Maybe he thought he could work with him. Putin was one of, I guess there were a few leaders, but certainly stands out as a leader Trump really never issued any criticism of whatsoever. So it was a bad day, to say the least. And I think people in the administration recognize that. I don't think the president recognized that and won't to this day.
No.
Every single policy that Trump did.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
You know, was favorable to Putin in one way or another. His comments was always minimizing America or comparing America to Russia. I mean, when he was asked the famous question, like, do you think Putin is a murderer? I mean, oh, so are we. Like, who says this? No, we don't go and kill journalists. We don't go and kill, you know, opposition figures. Like, no, this is not who we are. So, I mean, that thing, I agree. That summit was, I think, the final, like, you know, thing that was like the most blood boiling thing I've watched.
So let me just make one comment on that. I agree with what you've just said. And I think President Trump's solicitousness toward Putin really is striking. There was really nothing Putin could do that would elicit a condemnation from President Trump. That said, there were parts of his administration that did do some good things. And that's why there's such a baffling disconnect between Trump and his rhetoric and what his administration was doing. For example, the administration signed off on providing lethal military assistance to Ukraine. And the Obama administration, President Obama, refused to do that after Ukraine had been invaded in 2014. And just for your listeners to understand, Ukraine was not asking us to send troops to Ukraine to fight a battle with Russia. They were asking for the military means by which to defend themselves against this Russian threat. And Obama refused to do it. The Trump administration did it. They did beef up the U.S. military presence in countries along Russia's border. They increased the export of liquefied natural gas, LNG, to the region. They did continue sanctions. Now, to be clear on sanctions, the Trump administration, in its very first week in office, the White House was trying to get sanctions lifted on Russian officials. And this was a major concern of a lot of us on the outside at the time, that there was an understanding that President Trump was with Putin, that he was going to come in and lift these sanctions. But the reaction at that time from key members of Congress, including Senator McCain, but I would also remind everyone, Senator McConnell at that time spoke out very forcefully and very quickly to warn the White House against lifting sanctions as one of its first acts in office. And so the sanctions stayed in place. They were not implemented aggressively, but there were some additional sanctions. Not enough, in my view. But so that's why there's just a baffling disconnect between what Trump himself was saying and doing and what the administration was doing. The result of that was not a policy, but dysfunction and chaos, because no one could figure out what was what.
Putin, I think, obviously
felt that as long as he had Trump's ear and support, it didn't particularly matter what other people in the administration were doing, as long as he could persuade Trump to be friendly and stay on his side.
Yeah. I remember Fiona Hill saying, in fact, that there were two lines in foreign policy, one that Trump had and the other one that the administration or the Secretary of State and all of state had working.
And the Pentagon. You know, absolutely. I think that's right, Monique. I think there was just a huge disconnect here.
I just think Trump didn't know what was going on. People were like, oh, yes, we could do what we need to do.
Or whatever we want to. Yeah.
I think that may be the case when it comes to the signing off of lethal military assistance to Ukraine. Yeah. There's another example I can cite. You know, we've touched on the Skripal poisoning. This, again, was Sergei Skripal, a former KGB officer, who fled and was living in Salisbury, England, and was nearly killed by polonium that had been spread on apparently the doorknob of his home.
Novichok.
Novichok. Yep. And in response to that, a number of European countries expelled a number of Russian diplomats, and the NSC staff, presumably Fiona Hill, whom we've mentioned, and others, got agreement that the U.S. would expel 60 Russian diplomats, which was more than any other country by far.
Yeah.
And after this was announced and after he realized nobody else came close to that number, Trump apparently was furious that the United States had taken such a step.
Yeah.
To me, it was the right thing to do. And yet he was upset that he had been talked into doing it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just very fishy. It's fishy. I think it's fishy. But we're talking about response, David. Okay. And we know that Putin's modus operandi is escalating, 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 pushing those red lines that we hear, okay, so much about. Why do you think in the West, okay, they haven't taken any decisive action at any point to stop all of this, okay, this escalation? Because this is what we're seeing, and it's extremely frustrating, right, for normal citizens to see that pretty much he gets away with everything. Why do we have such a weak response from the West? Like, when do we finally stand up to all of this? When is enough enough, right?
That's a good question. What's the response?
Yeah, you know, that's, we keep asking ourselves as well.
But, you know, and just for your listeners, just to be clear, we're talking about, yes, the games that Putin and the Kremlin are playing when it comes to delivery of gas in Europe, which is really driving up the price of gas in the European continent. And this is, unfortunately, it's been abetted by the Germans with the completion of construction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which unfortunately the Biden administration issued waivers on, sanctions that were congressionally mandated. It comes in the form of cyber attacks and ransomware attacks. And let's remind our viewers again that it's about the Colonial Pipeline that disrupted energy flows in the United States. We're not talking about Europe. We're talking about the United States. Cyber attacks and ransomware attacks against hospitals in the middle of a pandemic.
A child died because
of that. I mean, this, we're talking about hostile acts that, if carried out by pretty much any other country, would have been deemed an act of war.
Exactly.
And you're right that we really have not done much of anything until 2014, when sanctions were imposed in response to Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and then military invasion of eastern Ukraine, the Donbass region. But the problem, and then there were additional sanctions that the Obama administration imposed in December 2016 as was on its way out the door for interference in the election. But we're too slow, and we don't understand the need to keep ramping up the pressure. An article just came out in the Washington Post as a result of the release of these Pandora papers that indicates that the sanctions have had an impact. Hasn't necessarily changed the behavior of the Kremlin, but have made life more difficult for Russia's oligarchs, the people close to Putin who depend on him for the billions of ill-gotten gains that they make. And so I don't think any of us wants to go to war with Russia, but we have to understand that unless we push back and impose serious consequences on the Putin regime, including, I would argue, Mr. Putin himself, there aren't bank accounts with Vladimir Putin's name on them.
But
we have a good sense of who's keeping his money for safekeeping. Unless we do that, this kind of stuff is going to continue. President Biden, in his meeting in Geneva, said he'll give Putin 6 months. Well, the clock is ticking. And the cyber attacks, while they have not been getting as much attention, from what I can tell, have been continuing. And the ransomware attacks as well.
Yep.
And I don't know if we've done much of anything in response. There was one hacking group that went dark, but the suspicion is it went dark on its own, not because of any U.S. action.
And came back.
And came back. Meanwhile, we're sitting down with the Russians, engaging in talks on strategic stability. And John Kerry has traveled there to collaboration, cooperation on climate change. And the thing is, you know, Lavrov and Putin know how to wrap Kerry around their finger. And if I can just back up for a second, President Biden, I think, and his administration got off to a good start with dealing with Putin, with imposition of two rounds of sanctions, with Biden saying yes when asked directly whether he thought Putin was a killer. And support for the other countries in the region. But then as Putin was building up military forces along the border with Ukraine, something changed. And the White House either panicked or whatever the case may be and invited Putin to a summit. When you, if I were in the White House, I would not have advised rewarding Putin with a summit because of his military buildup along the border with Ukraine. Yeah. There was also concern, let's keep in mind, that the Russian opposition figure, Alexei Navalny, who had been poisoned by Putin's agents last summer, was on his deathbed in prison after he returned to Moscow January 17th and was thrown in jail immediately. So the concern about Navalny, the concern about a renewed invasion of Ukraine prompted the White House to go, in my view, soft and invite Putin to a summit in Geneva. And ever since, it seems the White House has pulled back from its harder line in dealing with Putin. And I think it's a mistake. And I hope that when the time period ends that President Biden said he would give Putin, that we take some really tough measures. I'm not convinced we will. The White House and the National Security Council in particular seems obsessed with China. That's not necessarily a wrong thing, but we ignore Putin at our own peril. And that's what I fear is happening now. Putin has an uncanny ability to remind us of the trouble he can create. And it's better to try to head it off before it happens.
So let's take a quick break. This episode is sponsored by Policy Genius.
The holidays are upon us, love. And you know what? There's a lot of people that are looking for life insurance, home insurance, but they really just don't have the time to sit in front of a computer and do that kind of thing. But Policy Genius makes it easy to compare quotes from over a dozen top insurers all in one place. You could save 50% or more on life insurance by comparing quotes with Policy Genius. And that amounts to something like even up to $1,300 or more per year.
The licensed experts at Policy Genius work for you, not the insurance companies. So you could trust them to help navigate every step of the shopping and buying process.
And eligible applicants can get covered in as little as a week, right? Thanks to an award-winning policy option that swaps the standard medical examination requirement for a simple phone call.
This exclusive policy was rated recently number one by Forbes Advisor, higher than options from Ladder, Ethos, and Besto.
That's right. When you're ready to apply, the Policy Genius team will handle the paperwork and scheduling for free. Policy Genius doesn't add any extra fees.
Head to policygenius.com to get started right now. Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right.
David, what is your advice to Biden? Let's say you have 5 minutes with Biden and you say, look, points 1, 2, 3, and 4. Can you give us, what your advice would be? I mean, I've read your op-ed in Politico, which was brilliant, and we'll be making sure that our listeners get to that op-ed. But can you give us, some points that you would like to make known to the administration?
Sure. Well, thanks for that. And let me just say on the specific issue of cyber before I get to, what 5 points I would stress. President Biden said that the United States has greater capabilities than any other country in the world when it comes to cyber. And I think that's right. Either we are holding back or we're doing things so covertly that no one knows about them, except maybe some targets in Russia.
It could be. I
think it's unlikely because I think this is not unique to the Biden administration. Administrations before have this aversion, understandably, to the concern about escalation. This was President Obama's excuse for not providing lethal military assistance to Ukraine, for example. He worried that Russia would escalate in response to that. By the way, when the Trump administration did provide lethal military assistance, Russia did not escalate. So that concern proved to have been unfounded. But yes, on cyber and ransomware attacks, we're going to keep getting hit unless we hit back really, really hard. And I think we have the capability to do that. And at some point, we have to decide Putin is not going to act on his own. The Kremlin argument, well, these are private actors. No. We don't control them. In a sense, Putin has created this environment in which this kind of activity at a minimum is condoned, if not encouraged. So I think we have to get much tougher and more serious on this. On the 5 points, one is let's recognize the threat that Putin poses. One, to his own people. Two, to his neighbors. Three, to us and our way of life and the democratic system. He is interested in staying in power as his number one objective. His number two objective is staying in power. And guess what his number three objective is? Staying in power.
Staying in power.
He will do whatever is necessary to achieve that goal. He's not interested, I would say, to President Biden, in predictability and stability, as the White House has used this phrase in seeking better relations with Russia. In fact, he depends on unpredictability and creating instability. It's important to understand that unlike a normal Western leader, Putin wants to destabilize his neighbors, specifically Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, even Belarus, so that these countries have no hope and prospect of joining NATO and the European Union or thriving as democratic states. Successful democracies along Russia's borders are inimical to Putin's interests. He does not want to see what he would view as a threatening alternative, particularly in a country like Ukraine, a fellow Slavic nation. And so he will invade it. He will try to destabilize it. He will feed into the corruption, which is a problem in a number of these countries. Yeah. And he will pose a threat to them. We don't have anything in common when it comes to values. We have very little in common when it comes to interests. And so coming to grips with this reality that Putin is a threat and needs to be dealt with accordingly. Again, I'm not calling for war with Russia.
No,
I don't know of anyone who is.
No,
but it's the old Trotsky line. You may not want war, but war may want you. If we continue to let Putin get away with these things, as we were talking about earlier in our conversation, he will continue to escalate.
Exactly.
And unless we provide him with a good reason that escalation is dangerous to him and his interest, he'll keep doing it. So to me, taking a tougher line, we shouldn't be paralyzed by concern that if we get tougher with Russia, we're going to drive it into China's hands.
Yeah.
David, it was a real, real pleasure speaking with you today.
Okay. Thanks very
thank
much for
you.
Having me. I enjoyed
no,
it.
Thank
I
you
appreciate
for
it very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank
that's
you.
Right.
Thank
we
you.
Need
we
you.
Need people who are more, you know, like forthright, because a lot of people don't like to talk about, you know, this and be as direct. They always kind of walk
skirt
the line. I'm
around.
Like, we're in a war right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, We're under attack. We need people who can tell us what's happening, not just,
exactly.
You know, just
well,
like,
say it how
well,
it is,
maybe.
Right, Olga?
Yeah.
Which is being truthful with people, because people need to see what reality actually is, not what others would like it to be. So this is actually extremely important to get this information out there in a very clear way, okay, without dressing it up in rhetoric and the whole business. So yes, I agree. I agree. Okay, David.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You so
appreciate
much.
It.
Hey, everybody. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe and please visit our website, KremlinFile.com. This is Season 1, Kremlin File, hosted by Olga Lautman and me, Monica Mata. This is a Bunker Crew Media production with executive producers Marley Clements, Jack Bryan, Grant DeSimone, Ben Brett, and Jordy Mycelis of Midas Media, with associate producers Ruby Franco and Sarah Metz. Theme music by Oreste Camarda. Sound editing and mixing by Joy Ellett. Subscribe to Kremlin File wherever you listen to podcasts.